You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, tens of millions of Americans have filed for unemployment since the economy slowed amid the COVID-19 outbreak. We'll talk to an economist about what to expect from the jobless numbers when they're released tomorrow and what it could take to turn things around. First, it was 30 years ago this month that we saw the first images from the Hubble Space Telescope. Since its launch back in 1990, it's given us some of our most incredible images of space and allowed scientists to see the cosmos in action, everything from star formation to evidence of dark matter. The Hubble isn't done yet, and new telescopes scheduled to launch in the next few years will add to our toolkit for astronomers and help us look even deeper into the universe. Ken Sembach is the director of the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, where he manages science operations for the Hubble. He also got his PhD at UW-Madison. Ken, via the airwaves, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be here.
Well, what made the Hubble Space Telescope such a game changer when it was first launched?
Hubble was the first really big telescope to be put above the Earth's atmosphere to give us a chance to see what the universe looked like at crystal clear resolution without all of the atmospheric effects that distort images that ground-based telescopes take.
And we talked to a planetarium director on the show yesterday and asked about the Hubble, given this conversation today. And he said, in effect, you can divide astronomy in some ways into pre-Hubble and post-Hubble. What kind of questions that we were just guessing at before Hubble have we answered since then? If you can give us a taste of a few of them.
Yeah, sure. Some very basic questions, like how old is the universe? We didn't know whether the universe was 6 billion years old or 13 billion years old at that time. And it's a really tough measurement to make. And Hubble was designed specifically to make that measurement. And the goal with Hubble was to get that number down to 10% accuracy. And so going from a factor of 2 down to 10%. And we did that. And we now know the universe is just under 14 billion years old. In fact, we're trying now to get that accuracy or that precision down to 3% and even 1%. Because if we can get the age of the universe to that level of detail, then we're going to be able to actually make some informed decisions about what kinds of physics might be at work in some of the early times in the universe.
Now, I've got a refrigerator that's about 15 years old. It's had two or three service calls in that time. Can you talk about the challenges of keeping a way fancier piece of equipment working in Earth orbit for 30 plus years?
Well, unlike telescopes on the ground, Hubble doesn't get visited very often. It has been visited by astronauts on 5 occasions, and each time they've upgraded the observatory's capabilities. But other than that, it's all remote work. And so if something goes wrong, you have to diagnose it. And if you can, fix it from the ground, either with software or a change of operating procedure. And when that isn't possible, the astronauts have gone up. NASA sent up astronauts to repair instruments, to change out gyroscopes and other subsystems on the observatory. At one point, the central computer was replaced. All of those things have made Hubble not only longer lived, but much more powerful as time's gone on. So today, Hubble's a much more powerful observatory than when it was launched originally 30 years ago.
We're talking to Ken Sembach, director of the Space Telescope Science Institute, where he manages the Hubble Space Telescope's daily operations. Ken, let's get a little closer to home. We have these, you know, distant images from Hubble that tell us about the formation of the universe and the formation of stars. What kind of things has Hubble helped us learn here in our own solar system?
In our own solar system, we've witnessed collisions between comets and asteroids in with the outer planets like Jupiter. We've seen changes in the ring structure of Saturn, different kinds of weather phenomena on Uranus and Neptune. We've studied the composition of Mars. We've made a lot of interesting measurements with Hubble at resolution that just isn't possible from the ground. And that's provided a new insight into the dynamical nature of the planets in our own solar system. We've also been able to study some of these comets and asteroids as they break up. They outgas and eventually they disrupt. We've seen these new interloping strangers coming from other stellar systems passing through our cosmic backyard here. And Hubble's always the preferred instrument to look at these objects because of its good angular resolution.
Let's talk about a thing I just learned about today, director's discretionary time, because it sounds pretty cool. You are able to look at projects and use about 10% of Hubble's time to designate what it's going to do. When you get your hands on the steering wheel like that, what kind of things have you been able to use it for?
Yeah, in principle, I have about that much time, but I don't actually use all of that. Mm-hmm. In fact, one thing I do is I have a standing call open to the astronomical community worldwide to send proposals in for observations that need to be obtained quickly or have an immediate impact, something that doesn't get selected or something that doesn't have time to be submitted to the normal peer review process, which we run once per year. So it gives astronomers a chance to respond quickly to things that are happening, dynamic things that are happening. Other than that, we also spend some time of my discretionary time on really big projects. And one that we're pushing forward right now is an ultraviolet legacy survey of stars. And that's going to form the basis for a lot of the information that we have about how stars form and evolve during their lifetimes. This will be the largest program that Hubble's ever done. We'll spend about 1,000 orbits of HST time on that.
I want to look ahead at another big thing coming up, the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope. It's been in the works, scheduled, I think, to launch next year. What do we expect to see from that?
Well, the James Webb Space Telescope is an obvious follow-on to Hubble. When we looked at the very deep universe with Hubble, we realized that we ran out of photons. We ran out of light. And the reason for that is because the universe is expanding and that light's being shifted to longer wavelengths. And so the James Webb Space Telescope is an infrared-optimized telescope that will have the ability to see detail as well or better than Hubble. And it will pick up that infrared light from the very beginning of the universe. So we'll see the first stars and galaxies forming. We'll be able to peer deeper into regions where stars form in our own galaxy. We'll get a good look at what the atmospheres of planets around other stars look like at infrared wavelengths to complement what Hubble now sees at ultraviolet and optical wavelengths. So it's going to be a really exciting time.
How much are we still going to see from Hubble? How long are we expecting or maybe hoping to see it keep working?
We're expecting that Hubble's got at least 5 more good years in it. The instrumentation and the subsystems and everything are operating really well. And right now we're planning at least another 5 years. It could go longer than that, but this is also the space business. And so you never know how long you have. So you do the best you can with the time that you've got. And we'll continue to select really great science, and the public will get to see really amazing images from Hubble in the coming years. But we're hopeful to have at least several good years of overlap with the James Webb Space Telescope. And who knows, maybe more.
And Ken, before I let you go, I want to talk about those images, even as a layperson who, you know, doesn't really understand that much about astronomy. The images we get, whether it's, you know, one of Jupiter's moons casting a shadow on a Jupiter itself or a nebula where stars are being formed, some of these images are just really beautiful. Do you ever take time to just sit back and appreciate how cool these are?
Absolutely. That's one of the best things about Hubble images, the fact that they have such a pleasing aesthetic value. They're full of wonder and color and possibility, it seems. They capture motion and they capture, you know, history of the universe. And so I spend a lot of time staring at them, and I'm sure other people do as well.
I do. Ken, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob.
That's Ken Sembach, director of the Space Telescope Science Institute, where he manages the Hubble's daily operations. He's also a UW-Madison graduate. He talked to us about what we've learned from 30 years of the Hubble's images and what's next in astronomy. Coming up, we'll talk about the impact COVID-19 is having on the economy ahead of the release of the latest jobless numbers. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The latest appointee to the Wisconsin Ethics Commission is bringing a bit of controversy to the position. Coming up, our guest says there's no place for vitriolic partisanship on a serious bipartisan government panel. We'll meet the appointee himself as well. First, more than 33 million Americans have filed for unemployment since March, when states began issuing stay-at-home orders that forced non-essential businesses to close during the COVID-19 outbreak. According to the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, more than 500,000 people have sought unemployment assistance in the state. We'll get official jobless claims numbers tomorrow from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, but everything we have so far paints a bleak picture of the impact the pandemic has had on the economy. Our next guest joins us to talk about the numbers and what they could mean for the economy in the coming months. Abdur Chaudhry is a professor emeritus in the Department of Economics at Marquette University. Abdur, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me on your program.
Well, big numbers here of people applying for unemployment. Can you put this, Abdur, in perspective for us?
Yes. As this morning, the jobless claim number came out, 3.2 million people applied for unemployment insurance in the week ending on May 2nd. So if you take from mid-March, in the last 7 weeks, about 33.5 million Americans have applied for unemployment insurance. Just to give you some perspective, tomorrow the Department of Labor is going to release the unemployment numbers, and all indications are that more than 21 million Americans have lost their jobs in the month of April, which is, and the unemployment rate most likely will be somewhere in the range of 15% to 20%, the highest unemployment we have seen in a very long time. And just to give you some perspective, if 21 million Americans lose jobs, that would mean that all the jobs that has been created in the last 10 years will be lost.
I had seen some reports that we had started to see job losses along these lines, or at least the start of it, even before shutdowns started. How do we tease out how much of this might be the fears about the epidemic and the direct impact of the epidemic itself versus the shutdowns, the state and federal government response to that pandemic? Or is that even a distinction worth making?
The distinction would be very small, I would say. Most of the jobless claims that we see now has been because of the shutdown.
And what are you looking for when it comes to how we emerge from these levels of unemployment?
It will take a long time for us to get back to the January-February situation in terms of the number of jobs that we have in this country. The reason is many business firms will not be able to survive this shutdown. We will see some small business firms going under. So, for example, before this virus, unemployment rate in the U.S. was 3.5%, the lowest we have seen in 50 years. Now, my guess is that when everything is said and done, things stabilize, we are not going to see that 3.5% unemployment rate. Unemployment will be somewhere in the 5% to 6% range. The reason is, as I said, many businesses will close and there will be some who will lose their jobs for a very long period of time.
When you look at the federal efforts, especially the third stage, the economic recovery package of $2 trillion, do you see that as an effective way to help individuals and businesses weather the storm here?
It is. I would say it's a step in the right direction, but we do need to do more, especially for the states and local government. That is something that hasn't been done much. Most of the states are now running a huge deficit. They cannot cover their unemployment claims, for example, among other things. Just to give you an idea, in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin state government has so far paid about $380 billion as unemployment insurance claims. So the state governments do need federal help. The local governments do need that too. So we are looking forward towards the Congress. Hopefully they will come up with another, at least $500 trillion or more aid to the state and local governments.
We're talking to Abdur Chaudhry, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Economics at Marquette University, looking at big, big unemployment numbers over the last month. More bad news expected when official numbers come out tomorrow. Abdur, do we know what kind of sectors, what parts of the economy are being hit the most when it comes to unemployment?
Yes, it's mostly the service sector that has been hit the most. And as we know, restaurants have closed, travel has been affected. So the service sector where we see most of the job losses.
Unemployment was changed some in the economic recovery packages. So now contractors, independent contractors, so-called gig workers and people like that are able to apply for unemployment benefits. Is that something you see as being a helpful change?
Yeah, any help would go a long way at this point. We do see a lot of self-employed people who doesn't have any income. You know, their business has stopped completely. So any type of assistance would help these people in go a long way.
Looking at the stock market, it dropped, of course, a lot in the early days. It seems to have stabilized, not come close to its past levels. What are you watching for on the stock market side of things?
On the stock market, obviously, there are so many different factors that affect the stock market. I don't see the stock market going down the way it did the first couple of weeks. It has stabilized a little bit, but it will stay at this level for some time. There will be some volatility in the market, but I don't see the stock market crashing.
The word recession has a technical meaning in how we measure it. It seems like we must be in one or headed there. How do we actually make that call?
Actually, technically, the way we call recession is if our GDP growth rate drops for two consecutive quarters. Now, for example, the first quarter GDP has dropped by 4.8%. The numbers came out last week. And there are all signs indicate that in the second quarter of 2020, we will see a much larger drop in GDP growth in the U.S. So technically, I would say the U.S. is already in a recession.
And with a recession going on, big government spending aimed at trying to address this, there are concerns about the impact on the federal deficit. Is that something that you find yourself worrying about at this point?
No, not much really. Obviously, the federal deficit will increase. Indications are that it will reach a level of about $5 trillion this year. This fiscal year. But I think at this point, an immediate concern for everyone is how to revive the economy. So we can think about the deficit a little bit later once things stabilize.
Now, Abdur, we've had bad economic times in the past, the Great Recession of 10 years ago or so, the Great Depression, of course. But this seems really different in some ways. Are there any roadmaps we can learn from past economic downturns that apply here?
This is a little bit different in the sense that, everything abruptly stopped and we are in uncharted water from that point of view. What I see happening is later this year, in the fourth quarter or early 2021, I do see a comeback in the U.S. economy. It'll be a little bit sort of a prolonged upturn in the economy. So what I see is a U-shaped recovery in the U.S. economy. Going forward, because we are in uncharted territory, as you all know.
Now, if all the shutdowns ended tomorrow, I think some businesses would do okay there. But I've seen concerns that are people going to want to go right back into restaurants or stadiums or things like that, even absent the shutdowns? Do you see this as a slow crawl back to recovery?
Yes, that's why I'm saying it'll be sort of a U-shaped. The reason is, as you said, if restaurants open tomorrow, I'm not sure that many people are willing to go to the restaurant at this point. So you will see a very slow recovery taking place. You know, things will come back to normal after a certain period of time.
I wanted to ask you, we've talked in the past about the oil market, Abdur, and we had that strange scenario where at least one of the oil future prices was negative dollars. People would pay you to take it off their hands if you could get it and store it. What's going on with oil?
Yeah, what has happened in the oil is we see the reason the price dropped so much was, on one hand, we saw an increased supply of oil in the world market. There was a supply glut. On the other hand, we saw a decreased demand because of the shutdown in the economy globally. So this decreased demand and increased supply led to this sharp decline in price. Now that you know, countries are opening up slowly, U.S. states are opening up slowly, in the last week or so, we have seen a slight upturn in demand. That's why if you look in Wisconsin, for example, in the last week, you'll see prices at the pump has increased slightly.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Abdur, when we're through all of this, hopefully sooner than later, are there lessons here for building a more resilient economy so that maybe the next pandemic we can weather it a little better?
Basically, I think the main lessons learned is that we do need to listen to the experts, especially the health experts, and we need to follow their the guidelines that they set for us. We don't want to open the economy too fast and the virus come back again, reemerge a second time. So I think one of the things we have learned from the pandemic is we do need to listen to the health experts more carefully.
Abdur, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me on your program. Thank you.
Abdur Chaudhry is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Economics at Marquette University. He joined us for a look at big numbers of unemployment claims during the COVID-19 outbreak and what it could take to turn things around. Coming up, we'll get two takes on the appointment of former One Wisconsin Now Executive Director Scott Ross to the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on the morning show, it's Kids Time. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests take calls and questions from children and their parents. And this week's guest is children's book author Lauren Tarshis. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Wisconsin Republican Party says it's seeking help to, quote, stand up against hypocrisy. In particular, they're focusing on the Democrats' latest appointment to the State Ethics Commission. 2 weeks ago, outgoing Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling named former One Wisconsin Now Executive Director Scott Ross to the panel. In a statement, Schilling praised Ross for advocating for clean, open, and transparent government and for championing high ethical standards. Yesterday, the state GOP sent a fundraising email to supporters. It read, quote, Ross has spent years tweeting vile and unhinged things about Wisconsin Republicans and now will have the opportunity to rule on matters that come before the Ethics Commission, end quote. The Ethics Commission administers state laws regarding campaign finance, lobbying, and ethics. Ross's term will expire in 2024. Our first guest says Ross is not a good choice for that ethics post. Jake Curtis is a Milwaukee attorney who served as chief legal counsel for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources under the Walker administration. He was also an associate counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. He wrote about the Ross appointment in National Review. Jake, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, make the basic case. Why do you think Scott Ross was a poor choice for this ethics panel?
Sure. You know, many attorneys in the state are familiar with the Ethics Commission. It has, you know, very serious responsibility. I thought your summary was a good one. It deals with the state's lobbying laws, ethics for not only state officials, but local officials, really every local public official throughout the state, whether it's a school board, town, village, city, county, there's always ethical questions that come up. You know, there's obviously the the type of situations where, you know, high profile ethics concerns, but typically most of these questions are going to be very technical in nature. And it's the ethics commission that has a responsibility to help local officials by either providing kind of informal guidance, or when a matter rises to the level of the full commission actually addressing a complaint or a concern, there'll be published decisions. And those decisions are relied on by attorneys and public officials throughout the state. So the point is, it's a very serious responsibility. And you know, over the years, there have been individuals, former members of the legislature, two out of the six positions are statutorily former judges appointed by the governor. And you know, right now we have the former deputy attorney general, former member of the assembly. And you know, it's not a partisan thing. Representative Hintz's appointment is a well-respected attorney from the Fox Valley, who has, you know, spoken out independently on various issues, including the John Doe investigations. So really, across the spectrum, it seems like most of the appointments have been folks within the mainstream that take this responsibility seriously. And I struggled to find anybody that would put Mr. Ross in that category. I've never met Mr. Ross. I don't know him. I just kind of look at his Twitter feed. I look at his commentary regarding almost exclusively Republicans. Every once in a while, he makes a comment about a Democrat, but it seems specifically focused on Republicans. And so, you know, one has to wonder, with a commission like the Ethics Commission that's handling very serious, sensitive matters, the Ethics Commission has pretty significant powers itself. It can subpoena records, subpoena witnesses. So a lot of responsibility. You have to wonder whether or not Mr. Ross really was the best choice to provide, you know, really an objective analysis. And again, you know, to be clear, the system is set up whereby both the minority and the majority legislative parties get an appointment. So I'm not suggesting that these appointments are not going to be partisan. By statute, they will essentially be partisan by both the Senate and the Assembly, majority and minority parties getting those appointments. But the system is set up so that those appointments result in a balanced commission. And like I said, the appointment by Representative Hintz was a serious one, a good lawyer, a respected lawyer, that's a Democrat.
I want to jump in. You mentioned that it's okay that these are partisan appointments. That's the nature of the thing. But your criticism and other people's criticism of Ross is the nature of the way he expresses himself in public. And we could talk about that a little. Asked about that by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Ross was quoted as saying, "I don't think free speech belittles any democratic institution." So how do we draw a line between saying this kind of partisan speech is okay for an ethics commission member? This crosses a line that we shouldn't cross.
I think it's a good question. But the reality is, and look, I previously was at Wisconsin Sioux Falon Liberty. As you mentioned, it's an organization that's focused on many issues and an issue like free speech. And they've on the record defended individuals that frankly, you know, probably are not politically aligned. And at the end of the day, I would certainly support Mr. Ross's right to free speech and to use platforms like Twitter to comment on, frankly, whatever, you know, comes to mind. But then it's a question, just because somebody has a right to do something, you know, doesn't mean that, you know, automatically they're then qualified to serve on something like the Ethics Commission. And so, I you know, it's not a statutory line or anything like that. It's just, frankly, kind of common sense. Was this an appropriate appointment by Senator Schilling? And I think, you know, it's not just, you know, conservatives. You know, I as you mentioned, I had the piece in National Review, but the State Journal has come out with a pretty strongly worded editorial. Dan Bice from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently ran a piece kind of looking at some of his recent tweets since being appointed to the commission. You know, that's, I think, one point that people are making. I guess if you were going to appoint him and there was maybe an understanding that he would kind of tone down some of the rhetoric, then I guess maybe that would be acceptable to some people, but he's not even doing that. So yeah, absolutely. He can comment on whatever he wants to comment on, but then it's a question of if you're going to serve on an ethics commission, you know, are you going to be able to provide that sort of objective analysis?
Right. One of the things you're referring to on Monday, I think Ross retweeted doctored photos of Michigan protesters whose guns were replaced by giant sex toys during a protest of the state's stay-at-home order. Is that the kind of an example of the tone that has you concerned about seriousness on this ethics commission?
Well, I think that would be one of many examples. And look, I mean, that's, I guess, a perfect example from the standpoint he can comment on whatever he wants to. And frankly, you know, there were many people across the political spectrum that thought that, you know, folks that, you know, were showing up with firearms to a protest probably wasn't the most reasonable thing to be doing. But if you're going to use that sort of kind of incendiary Twitter post to make your point, it begs the question, are you really going to take your responsibility as the ethics commissioner seriously? And, you know, I'm sure Mr. Ross will say that he's going to, and I hope he does. But then I would think, particularly in Wisconsin, where we've been, you know, very polarized, you know, maybe it's a good idea to try to kind of tone down some of the rhetoric and try to be objective in your comments, even when, you know, some may disagree with your policy positions. But to then take it to that next level of, you know, as you pointed out, putting what I think many would consider a pretty vile tweet out that, you know, people saw, and now you are an ethics commissioner, I think it just calls into question that objectivity.
In our last minute or so, this is one out of six appointments on a commission that, as you say, does important work, not exactly a household word, I think, among the public. How seriously do you think people should take this?
I think they should take it very seriously. You know, we expect our public officials to be ethical. And in my experience, I work with local public officials. We work with officials at the state level. In my experience, you know, despite, you know, what we hear, you know, as far as rhetoric and polarization goes, in my experience, most public officials, Republicans and Democrats, are trying to do the right thing when it comes to ethics laws. In fact, most of these officials preemptively seek opinions to, you know, essentially get approval for something that they're going to do. It may be attending a conference and at which they may, you know, get a meal and get some sort of, you know, if it's a gift or award, the question is, well, then who owns it? I mean, these get to be really technical questions. And in my experience, most of these public officials take that responsibility to abide by the state ethics code very seriously. And I just think our commissioners should be kind of held to that same level of seriousness.
Jake, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jake Curtis is a Milwaukee attorney who served as chief legal counsel for the Wisconsin DNR under the Walker administration. We talked to him about his concerns regarding the appointment of Scott Ross to the State Ethics Commission. Coming up, Ross himself joins us for a look at the criticism he's received and his goals on that ethics panel. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion about Scott Ross's appointment to the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. Ross is former executive director of One Wisconsin Now. He was named to the panel 2 weeks ago by outgoing Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling. We just heard from a critic of Ross's appointment. Now we hear from Ross himself. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Hey, how are you today? Thanks for having me on, and I hope this finds you and the whole Wisconsin Public Radio team doing safe and sound, and thank you for the good jobs that you're doing keeping us informed.
Thanks. Now, we heard the case against Scott Ross being on the Ethics Commission. Could you make the case for?
Well, first of all, I mean, it is an incredible honor to have been appointed to this important body. I am humbled by the opportunity. I'm ready to get to work with my colleagues who are Republicans and Democrats on this ethics commission to do the good work of that commission. I think that, you know, the experience that I have as an advocate, as somebody who's worked on campaigns, on somebody who's worked in advocacy, and somebody who's traveled around the state and around the country, espousing views, looking into things, being a watchdog, I think it's a great opportunity for me. And I am, again, humbled to serve the people of Wisconsin in this manner. And I'm going to do so with all of the best intentions. And listen, anybody who agrees with me 100% of the time should definitely rethink that position. My point is that, you know, I think there are things we can come together on. I think that the Ethics Commission has been that kind of body since it was established. You know, and again, let's not forget, the Ethics Commission was established like this because the Republicans who were in charge, got rid of the Government Accountability Board because the Government Accountability Board had investigated Scott Walker for violating campaign finance laws and illegally coordinating with outside independent groups. So they got rid of the Government Accountability Board. They created this commission. And now Republicans are crying and whining because a Democrat has appointed a Democrat to the commission. That seems a little bit disingenuous to me, Rob.
It's there are other Democrats who have been appointed to the commission. They say it's not so much that you're a partisan, because as you say, these are supposed to be partisans. It's the personal invective that you aim at Republicans, people you might have to consider, you know, the merits of their case before the ethics commission. They point toward a profanity in your attacks on them online. How do you? It's not just the partisanship. It's the style, I think.
Well, I think the thing is that Republicans are complaining about me, not because what I wrote on Twitter, but because what I was able to accomplish with that amazing team that I had at One Wisconsin now for 12 years. I mean, let's not forget, Rob, you know, the Republicans tried to end early voting in the state of Wisconsin. And One Wisconsin Now, we went to court with the with our then counsel and now Attorney General Josh Call, and we restored early voting to the state of Wisconsin. I mean, can you imagine during this pandemic when Republicans forced us to go to the polls, how bad it would have been on Election Day if we hadn't been successful in court and allowed the restoration of full early voting to the state of Wisconsin and kicked out all the restrictions that they had? I mean, listen, that the decision in that case, the judge specifically noted that Republicans tried to curtail early voting because they wanted to target the reliably Democratic African-American population in Milwaukee. I mean, he was explicit in his decision. I have absolutely, with passion, called out Republicans for engaging in these, you know, 21st century Jim Crow tactics. And I'm not going to stop doing that because, you know, they're not stopping. I mean, we just saw today that the Republican Party is launching the Republican National Committee is launching a $20 million $20 million fund to try and go after voting rights laws. I mean, they're not stopping. And yet I am supposed to stop in having these passionate feelings that I have. You know, again, I wasn't surprised at some of the criticism. You know, it came from talk radio. It came from, you know, your previous guest who worked for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We've certainly called out the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. I think it's appalling that, you know, Justice Rebecca Bradley continues to sit on cases in the Supreme Court that are argued by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty because, you know, Rick Essenberg, the head of that outfit, you know, was her political mentor, wrote recommendation letters for her, you know. They're not crying about her sitting on cases, but they're going to complain about, a partisan in Senator Schilling making a partisan appointment to a board that is appointed with partisans. So I just, you know, I mean, we just have to, I think everybody just has to play by the same rules. And if it wasn't, you know, some occasional offhanded adult language on Twitter, it would be something else they were complaining about. Maybe like, I don't know, I ride my bicycle too much or, you know, I don't know. But, you know, if it wasn't this, it'd be something else.
Could you see yourself in a position where you had to hold a Democrat accountable in an ethics complaint? Could you hold them accountable?
Listen, Rob, I've been in politics for 25 years, and anybody who knows me knows I get more angry at Democrats for what they do than a lot of times what Republicans do. So absolutely. I mean, and again, this board requires it. Any real action taken by the Ethics Commission requires bipartisanship. And so I'm going to, you know, I'm looking forward to meeting my new colleagues. I'm looking forward to finding out what makes them tick. I hope they, you know, are interested in finding out about me. And I'm looking for a really, really positive opportunity here. And again, you know, I understand why Republicans are unhappy. I mean, they've had to see me on television for the last 12 years. You know, I mean, I'm a pundit on Wisconsin public television. You know, me and my Republican partner were on the Unspun show on 15 in Madison, where we were actually named by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association as the best political show. Incidentally, they did get rid of the award after that, but that's neither here nor there. But, you know, for me, a lot of times what I find is that, you know, there are behaviors that are going on that need to be called out. And I have a privileged position to be able to do that as somebody who could get paid attention to from time to time because of the good work that we did at One Wisconsin Now. And I think I used my power for good. Now, I definitely have strong opinions about politics. There's no doubt about that. I don't hide those. But I also think that, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic, where Republicans just went to the Republican state Supreme Court to try and force people to go back to work, even though it may be against their interests, and they may have to choose between keeping themselves and their families safe or losing their jobs.
And that's all the time we have. Thanks to Scott Ross for joining us, former executive director of One Wisconsin Now, new appointee on the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. We also heard from a critic of his appointment. Wisconsin's April election drew national attention as the state voted amid the global pandemic. Now on May 12th, the state's largest congressional district is doing it again. Republican Tom Tiffany faces Democrat Trisha Zunker in a special election for the vacant congressional seat there. As Rob Metzer reports, Democrats are hoping to turn heads in the increasingly conservative district. Zunker is hoping to make history.
In her basement, Trisha Zunker displays a collection of traditional Ho-Chunk baskets woven by women like her grandmother. In a campaign video she put out in November, she talks about how making baskets helped poor families earn some extra income.
In my grandmother's time, our Ho-Chunk relatives sold baskets like these on the side of the road to make ends meet and preserve their way of life.
Zunker is the Democratic nominee in the 7th Congressional District's special election. The Northern Wisconsin District was held by Democratic Representative Dave Obey for four decades, but it went Republican after Obey retired in 2010, and it stayed that way. The seat became open when former Representative Sean Duffy resigned in September. Zunker would be Wisconsin's first Native American member of Congress, and she's the state's first Native American congressional candidate in nearly three decades.
Ho-Chunk Nation, we are the people of the big voice.
Zunker is president of the Wausau School Board and a justice on the Ho-Chunk Supreme Court. She's Ho-Chunk on her dad's side. Her mom's side were dairy farmers for generations in central Wisconsin. In an interview with WPR, she said her upbringing taught her the value of hard work and the importance of having politicians on your side.
I understand struggle, and I also understand that if you don't have people in certain positions that are arguing for you, that are trying to enact laws that will be beneficial for you, well, that's problematic.
The historic nature of Zunker's candidacy is part of what has attracted national attention to her campaign. She's gotten the endorsement of former presidential candidates Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker and left-leaning celebrities including Julianne Moore and Bradley Whitford. She's also managed to raise more money for her campaign in 6 months than the last two Democrats who ran in the district combined. The 7th District voted for Trump by 20 points in 2016. In this special election, Democrats are hoping to tap into the district's Democratic roots and to lay the organizing groundwork for November.
There's a deep vein of progressivism that runs through the north of Wisconsin.
Ben Wickler is chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. In an interview with WPR after Duffy announced his resignation, he said the district is winnable.
Often special elections favor the party with the higher voter intensity, and I think Democrats are really fired up.
The global pandemic put an end to in-person campaign events. Zunker spends her days on the phone and on Zoom calls.
Thank you, Kelly, and thank you, everybody, for attending tonight.
At a virtual listening session in April, she said she's hearing from people about their own concerns about slowing the virus's spread, including a lack of personal protective equipment for some workers.
I was just on a call with some union members hearing how they have to fight for this PPE. They're on the front lines, and they don't have what they need to address this, what they need to do in their jobs, and it's just wrong.
The virus also changed which issues may be most salient in the race. Zunker's opponent, Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany, put out a statement critical of Congress's first relief bill because it mandated sick leave for employees. In a campaign ad that's running in Wausau, Superior, and St. Croix County, Zunker attacks Tiffany on this and on his healthcare stances.
Not Tom Tiffany. He opposed the law that protects patients with pre-existing conditions who are most at risk for COVID-19. And he spoke against the bipartisan bill signed by President Trump to help small businesses hit hard by the pandemic.
On her call with supporters in the district, Zunker said the pandemic has made her even more determined. The special election is May 12th, but that's not the end. Both candidates have said they'll start running immediately for re-election to a full term in November. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can hear a profile of Trisha Zunker's opponent, Republican Tom Tiffany, at this time tomorrow. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, two psychologists share advice on keeping our spirits up during a pandemic based on the latest research into the workings of the human mind. We continue our interviews with the candidates for Congress in this month's special election in Wisconsin's 7th District. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Community cookbooks used to be a really common tradition in neighborhoods, churches, and elsewhere. Our guest says it's time to bring them back. Find out how you can make that happen and maybe share your own memories. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, find out how Wisconsin's zoos are coping with the ongoing pandemic, what the animals are up to while the zoos are closed, and what you could see online in the meantime. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk to the host of the podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression, about his new book by the same name. He shares what he's learned from talking to entertainers like Peter Sagal, Margaret Cho, and John Green, and from his own experience living with depression. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.